your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Cheeks and warm the heart, but tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about working with poisonous plants of the witch's pharmacopoeia for magic healing and visions with my guest, Kobe Michael. Now, Kobe's a practitioner of the poison path of occult herbalism and a cultivator of entheogenic herbs. He contributes to pagan archives at Valladolid University, writes regularly for the House of Twigs, and maintains a blog, Poisoner's Apothecary, on Pathos Pagan. He teaches classes and online workshops on plant magic, baneful herbs, and traditional witchcraft. And he's here tonight to talk about his book, The Poison Path Herbal. Now, Kobe will be happy to answer any questions you have in the chat room. And if you do have a question and aren't here in chat, get yourself over to paraxradionetwork.com and join us in. All right, Kobe, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
This is a great book. It's a guide to the path of occult herbalism, and you share history and lore and practical information on these plants. But before we get into the book first, let's talk about your history with the poison path.
Yeah, so I've been working with poisonous plants, growing them and incorporating them into my spiritual practice for about 10 years now, give or take, researching their history and lore and getting to know them on a more intimate level to kind of piece together, a new way of working with them, a different way of kind of conceptualizing some of these power plants that are very associated with magical practice.
So I've been in
the garden, since I was a little kid, so that goes way back, but poison plants about 10 years.
Okay. What kind of made you think about that at all? I mean, because, when I was growing up and thinking of those kind of plants, it was just kind of neat. I had the whole collection. I really wanted all these carnivorous plants to grow. And I never could get them to grow because I guess I didn't have the right humidity and all that. But, I was kind of interested in that kind of thing. So did it first catch you because it was kind of like taboo, or how did it draw you in?
I think so. I remember buying little Venus fly traps, at the supermarket when I was a little kid and growing them and feeding them little flies and things like that. And just being kind of fascinated by them because they were part plant, part creature. And, you hear about these baneful herbs or poisonous plants, and they often have these, sometimes monstrous or otherworldly kind of characteristics about them, where they in themselves sort of become these sort of magical creatures. And, so that really piqued my interest. And it really wasn't until, at least 10 years into my magical practice and, my practice with working with plants in general, that I really started to look at poisonous plants as a viable and, traditional way or traditional option that people had actually been working with these plants. A lot of what you hear is that, so many of the ingredients that sound fantastical, like wolfsbane, mandrake, batwing, eye of newt, things like that, were all added to you know, for theatrical effect or as sort of a code or something like that. But looking a little bit deeper, you know, there's actual tradition and ethnobotanical knowledge about these plants. So that was really what caused me to want to dive deeper, was the first realization that people were actually using them.
Yeah. You know, and I was thinking about the fact that some plants were considered to be poisonous and got a bad rap as poisonous, even though they weren't. I mean, tomatoes were once upon a time called poison apples. And in the 18th century France, potatoes were taboo because they caused leprosy and rampant unchecked sexual urges. I mean, you know, but baneful herbs have been used medicinally, magically, and for other purposes pretty much since time began, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so these are plants that have very potent chemical effects. You know, they're very medicinally powerful. Any plant that creates a dramatic effect in human physiology is going to attract some kind of notice. And, you know, if you add on top of that, that the plant, you know, is not only potentially poisonous, but also psychoactive or capable of altering consciousness or facilitating these different spiritual experiences, you know, you start to get a lot of superstition and buzz, you know, sort of surrounding the use of them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Thomas Hatzis has been on the show a couple of times talking about his books. And I love the part of the blurb that he wrote for your book that said that this book wasn't for the faint of heart, that you're a real witch, and this is a book of real witchcraft. So by the title, I think when people read a comment like not for the faint of heart, they probably immediately think that anything to do with poisons is kind of dark and evil and black magic and makes you a nasty practitioner using dastardly deeds, you know, using them for dastardly deeds. But again, in truth, I don't know that like every poisonous plant has a silver lining, but in most cases, you know, they do well. So how do you describe the poison path?
So I describe it just as it is occult in nature when we're speaking specifically of the poison path. You know, it is more associated with magical practice, with witchcraft, and things like that. And it does kind of branch out into the topic of psychedelic spirituality and ethnobotany, where we get into the different cultural ceremonial uses of different plants around the world, which are also of interest to the practitioner of the poison path. But most specifically, the name was kind of coined to denote a focus in the plants of medieval European witchcraft, namely the nightshades, deadly nightshade, henbane, datura, mandrake, and even things like hemlock and wolfsbane. So those are the kind of quintessential herbs associated with European witchcraft anyway, and those kind of make up the core of the poison path. And what when we start to kind of investigate that and sort of realize that other parts of the world also have this botanical knowledge, and the plants aren't looked at as these noxious poisons. You know, they're looked at as spiritual medicine or gifts from the gods or a means of, you know, gaining knowledge or insight into something. So if we can kind of apply that more traditional idea of a poisonous, medicinal, or potent plant to work with some of these others, then we can kind of recover some of these practices that would have been lost or demonized, you know, throughout the Inquisition and the witch trials, you know, with them wanting to kind of put a bad spin on traditional practices and natural medicine. So it's really kind of reverse engineering, you know, working with these plants.
Yeah, you know, lots of people recognize that you're talking about hemlock and wolfbane. By the way, I loved wolfbane when I was a teenager. I wore it around my neck. I thought it was cool, and nobody knew what the hell are you wearing. But anyway, you know, but wolfbane, mandrake, hemlock, they're poisonous plants, mostly people know them because of movies or TV, you know, like Harry Potter and Mandrake. But there are plants that are just as baneful that people don't realize and they might have in their gardens. And, you know, it's things like snapdragons and angel's trumpets and larkspur. And, you know, they and possibly there's going to be some people on New Year's Eve standing under a baneful plant at the stroke of midnight because some species of mistletoe are toxic. Mm-hmm. And so lots of people plan gardens according to color scheme or annuals versus perennials, that kind of thing, without thinking that some things might be potentially dangerous. So should everybody kind of pay closer attention to what they are planting? Because sometimes handling a baneful plant and inadvertently, like, you know, poking your eye or putting it in your mouth might get you an unpleasant surprise.
Yeah, it's definitely something that you want to at least be cautious or aware of, you know, especially if you are growing a food garden or if you're planning on eating any of these plants that you're not certain about, you know, definitely understanding that, because there are poisonous plants all around us and a lot of our ornamental plants and house plants are toxic in all sorts of different ways. And it's kind of more so investigating this concept of baneful and looking at a plant and saying, okay, what makes this toxic or baneful or dangerous, or kind of gives it that association? And therein kind of lies the secret to its medicine or to its magic, because not every plant is baneful in exactly the same way, and not every plant is baneful in the sense that it is deadly poison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I think a lot of people that I know, because they're all animal people, make sure that they don't put poisonous plants that would be detrimental to the cats and the dogs, mm-hmm. you know, like poinsettia Christmas, you know, that kind of thing, or holly berries. So I think a lot of people are aware of that, but sometimes, you know, you just like, oh, I love that plant. It's so pretty. It'll go in the, right over here. And it's, you know, look at the color. Look at the shape. I'm going to get it. And it could turn out to be something that you really don't want to have.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
Yeah, read the blurb before you buy the plant. I guess that's what it is if you're not sure. Got a chat room question. She says, what are some of the magical uses for ergot?
So that would be, you know, the fungus that grows on rye. So with that one specifically, we have more of an association with, let's say, the Eleusinian mysteries, you know, working with entities like Demeter, Ceres, Persephone, you know, associations with sort of that theme of grain and, you know, that would lead into kind of the sacrifice god if we're celebrating at Lunasaw. You know, so that would be my kind of loose association with that. I mean, if we're speaking from like a psychedelic spirituality perspective of taking LSD or taking ergot fungus, you know, for its psychoactive effects, you know, that's going to be more of an individual experience based on, you know, your setting and the intention behind the ritual and things like that. So the psychoactive and entheogenic components of these plants are really sort of jump off points to go in any number of directions. And then we've got more of their concrete sort of physical characteristics and magical correspondences that we can also draw from, you know, sort of using the tools that we would use for any other plant. So like its physical characteristics, its history, etymology of its name, different things like that.
And when I think of ergot, I think of the witch trials, because, you know, that's what, if I'm not mistaken, that's what some of the girls were affected by it. And that's why everybody got hung, because of the ergot in the silos or wherever they kept them.
Yeah, definitely. They say that, you know, from up until probably the 17th, 18th century, I think the majority of the population was under some kind of chronic hallucinogenic state, either ergot or darnel or some other kind of fungus in the grain.
So is all right, so I mean, this may be a stupid question, but, you know, when you have a loaf of rye bread at home and it starts going bad, is all that fuzzy stuff ergot, or is that just plain mold?
That's just mold. you know, the fungus is going to occur. It's little like black beads that you'll see growing up and along the grain. So I think with modern agriculture, a lot of that has been sort of separated out to where it doesn't really happen naturally anymore.
Hope it would just be interesting, you know, if everybody got high on bread mold. What a life, you know, because sometimes you don't see, you know, if you're in a hurry and you've got a loaf of bread in there and you just pick it up and you don't realize that you put it in the toaster or something, you make a sandwich and you don't realize that it has any mold on it until you take the first bite. And then you're like, you know, miserable. So, you know, it's okay. Never mind. Let me continue.
Don't eat your moldy bread.
Yeah, it doesn't taste good of all things. I don't care how harmless it might be, but it's nasty. So in the book, you talk, amongst other things, about how safely to cultivate the plants, then, you know, and the nature and the power of each plant and how to work with the plant spirit familiars. And it's good timing because I just got a chat room question about plant spirits. And they were asking if it was safe to work with baneful plant spirits because the nature of the plant sometimes isn't all sunshine and lollipops.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same that a lot of the anthropomorphic spirits that we work with or deities, you know, they have a duality. They're dark and they're light. You know, the plants are not inherently bad or inherently malicious or out to get us. You know, that's from our perspective. You know, the chemical constituents that are deadly to us are not harmful to them or necessarily to certain herbivores and things like that. So there's really no intention behind that. With that being said, they are associated with some darker themes that, you know, bring up a lot of fears and different taboos and things like that that we're connected to. And that's where these plants really kind of shine, because they're associated with those things. They kind of help to act as catalysts to kind of help us through those experiences. So using it more from kind of a shadow work perspective in, you know, the plant medicine is supportive through whatever kind of darker associations it may have. So like for belladonna, for example, is very good with all types of trauma, specifically of a sexual nature, gender issues, things like that. You know, so we can kind of look at some of the different characteristics that they have and then associate those with different states of mind or situations in our life. And that's where we're kind of drawing these correspondences from on how to work with these plants.
So let's talk a little bit more about plant spirits in case some people aren't familiar with them. So I believe that every plant has a spirit, and I talk to my plants and the spirits. Tell everybody how do you get in touch with your plant spirits? Let's start with the simple way.
For me, it's a combination of growing them and reading about them, or at least encountering them in their natural environment while reading about them. I think one kind of informs the other, and as you're growing a plant or watching it in its natural environment and sitting with it and kind of noticing all of these different details in its behavior and growing habits and things like that, you start to notice little subtle correlations in the history and the folklore and, you know, some of the existing magical associations, and it starts to kind of flip these switches in your mind. And it's a really kind of nonverbal thing that starts to happen, but you start to make all of these new connections. And that's what really gives you a sense for what the plant spirit is or what facet of the plant spirit's personality it's trying to convey to you.
Mm-hmm. So is it kind of stereotypical? I mean, can some let's say a mandrake spirit, plant spirit, could some of them be different than others, or do they all kind of have the same personality? I mean, are all plants exactly the same? I don't think so. So it kind of varies, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Just like their chemistry is going to vary. It's going to be based on the soil, the amount of light that it receives, and we're all also playing a role in that. You know, it's not a one-way street or a one-way relationship. You know, there's an exchange and a synergy there. So we are connecting with the spirits with which we have sort of an affinity, and the parts of them that we have an affinity with, or that correspond to something that we need to learn or to work through. So there's the idea that mandrake as a genus has its overarching plant spirit that would be kind of like a deva or an elemental, and it's just kind of a general spirit of mandrake that has all of its different qualities, and then there would be the individual plant spirits, which would be more along the lines of a daemon or a land spirit that's specifically tied to a specific plant or a specific area. And that's going to be more on an individual basis. And those differences are revealed, you know, just in working with them one-on-one. And you're going to tap into different characteristics. So a lot of plants manifest differently for different people. A lot of them are tricksters and associated with shape shifting. So even the way that they appear is going to be different.
Yeah, and I also, like, if I rescue a plant, you know, like you go into a store and they're on that 50-cent rack and they're on their last legs, you know, I that's where I get most of my plants. It's like going to the animal shelter. I think you get a more of an affinity when you either plant something by seed or help a plant that needs it, really. Do you think that makes any sense?
Yeah, totally. As difficult as it is sometimes to grow a plant from seed, it's nicer to go in the store and buy it when it's already halfway there. You're really gaining a lot from that process, even though it may not necessarily seem like it, or, you know, waiting for these little seeds to sprout, like, is not that exciting, and it's hard to be patient, but you're just forging that much deeper of a connection. And that's not to say that if you don't grow them from seed, or if you don't grow them yourself, that you're not going to be able to connect with the plant spirit, or that you're not going to be able to get the same benefit.
Yeah. But you just, it seems like when you start from the beginning, or you save a soul, you just feel a little bit more attached, and I'm sure they realize that. So, you know, they won't turn on you like maybe some would if it had a chance. All right, I'm going to jump around a little bit. I was reading in the book a little bit about the emperor in India who had a unique use of poison. He created poison maidens. Can you tell that tale? I really like that.
Yeah, so this was a very old myth that was allegedly this emperor had these maidens and would feed them poisonous plants and other venomous ingredients on a regular basis to kind of allow those toxins to build up in their bodies. And then he would send these beautiful maidens as gifts to rival kingdoms. And then through the toxicity of their skin and their, you know, everything running through their veins, they would actually transfer that poison to these people and be able to assassinate them. Now there's some discrepancy as to whether that's more of a folkloric allusion to these women simply being assassins that were knowledgeable on how to use these poisons. We have poison garments, poison gloves being given as gifts and things like that. So that's kind of where that idea of poison gift giving comes from.
Yeah, you know, and I've seen, I mean, I really like that, but I don't know when, it wasn't that long ago, but I was watching a rerun of some show from way back when, and it was kind of an assassin. The woman wore poison lipstick. And I'm thinking, okay, so she kissed somebody, they died. How is it she didn't? You know, I mean, it's right there in her mouth, on her lips. you know, but that's, you know, Hollywood for you, maybe.
Yeah. I think so, maybe.
but it probably came from that mythology. I mean, if that's what it is. And, you know, I mean, Morgan Le Fay giving, what's his name? That's really bad, King Arthur. You know, she gave him a gift of cloth that had been infused with poison. So, I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of hard to tell the truth from the stories and the folklore and the mythology, but it's all kind of pretty interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. And one more thing before we go to break, because this half hour went by really fast, mm-hmm. or almost did. I want to talk about baneful plants entheogens, what they are, what they're used for in general. And when we come back for the, you know, we'll talk about that more when we come back for the break. But I want to talk a little bit about the witch's ointment. So it is I'm going to say this just to make myself stupid. Entheogen, explain what that is, what people think, or, you know, a lot of people have heard the terms but don't know exactly what that kind of plant is.
Yeah, so the witch's ointment is an entheogenic preparation, and there are all different types of entheogenic preparations. And what that means is that these substances are capable of creating spiritual experiences. So the word entheogenic literally means to generate the divine within, whether that's an experience of the divine or connecting to a divine part of yourself or something along those lines. So within the term entheogen, creating these spiritual experiences, there's all different kinds of little types and nuances that we might use this key to these spiritual experiences for, whether it be divination, whether it's maybe to cast some sort of a spell or incantation while under that plant's influence, or, you know, to communicate with the spirit, the plant spirit, or something along those lines. So anything that's generating that spiritual perception within you is an entheogen.
Mm-hmm. And they're not all horrible. I mean, I think, there are certain tribes that, I forget what it's called, but it's a drink, you know, they drink and they get a little bit high and, you know, kind of travel, but just see things differently. And I mean, that's to this day, and it's, I guess it might be poisonous if they do too much, but it's a regular drink that they do all the time.
Yeah, definitely. There's things like that all over the world. You know, we have ayahuasca in South America. We've got iboga in Africa, Amanita muscaria all over the world. You know, so people using different plants to create these experiences. And that's what a lot of these shamanic cultures and traditions are based on, is knowledge received from these different hallucinogenic states.
They don't always have to be ingested, do they? I mean, some of them you can breathe in the smoke and that is just as well, right?
Yeah, smoking, topical application, those are all going to be acceptable ways of ingesting the medicine. That's going to be a little less intense than orally ingesting something. And that's always going to be dose dependent and dependent on the plants that you're using. But there's a wide variety of entheogens, you know, so we could even consider something like mugwort or blue lotus or clary sage. You know, while it has a very subtle kind of perceptual change, it still mm-hmm. has a perceptual change, and it can be used entheogenically for those different purposes.
Well, a lot of it in the 60s, we're using a lot with the magic mushrooms and everything. I mean, even marijuana or hashish. I mean, you know, I guess that's since the beginning of time that's been going on, just getting yourself in a different frame of mind and seeing things differently. It's kind of, you know, opens up your brain to thinking, I guess. I'm just got a chat room question. Have you been to the, okay, Alnwick Poison Garden?
No, I've not been to Alnwick yet. I have a friend who is the tour guide there and was nice enough to send me a little brochure from their gift shop. But I haven't been able to make it back over there during COVID and everything recently, so I haven't had a chance yet.
And where is it?
That is in Northumberland, so northern England, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, sounds interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to fly back in about 2 minutes, so everybody stay put, and I'll be back.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Throughout time, events have occurred that have shaped human history. Spirit voices from the past have many stories to tell, and for the past several years, channelers Barry and Connie Strom have been conducting live channeling sessions and relaying those stories and messages from those on the other side. We invite you to tune in to Barry and Connie's new show, Channeling History, on the Para-X Radio Network, every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, as they relay the messages of those voices from the past, the ones who have witnessed history firsthand, and those who have made history themselves.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks from Stirring the Cauldron. One of the best gifts that you can give yourself or to someone else on your Christmas list this holiday season is the gift of insight. And if your crystal ball is a bit murky, think about giving them or yourself a personalized yearly witch's oracle deck reading. This comprehensive reading gives you a heads up on what the universe has in store for you in the coming year, and the month-to-month guide offers you a chance to make necessary changes if need be before situations get out of hand, or give you a hint of something really good to look forward to. So if you want to treat yourself or someone else, pop over to marlabrooks.com, click on the More tab on the homepage menu, and then click on Readings to find out more. And have a very happy holiday season, and blessed be.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And yes, we are back. My guest is Kobe Michael, and we're talking about his book, Poison Path Herbal. Now, before the break, I kind of mentioned the witch's flying ointment, and you have two recipes in the book from way back in the 1500s, and one whose main ingredient was the fat of young children, and then you have a modern-day recipe that omits the baby fat, thankfully. So how does flying ointment work, and what would people use it for? What can they expect to have happen when they do?
So flying ointments are a very convoluted thing, and they've changed a lot throughout history. Today we would use them for spirit flight, so what we would call astral travel, dream walking, going to the witch's sabbat specifically, which is more, I think, more of a traditional witchcraft type of a thing, as far as the nocturnal congregation of spirits and the sort of that sabbatic imagery. But it's essentially used to leave the body and to travel to other worlds. It's used to descend to the underworld to communicate with the ancestors. It can be used as a ritual anointing oil as part of an incantation. So flying ointments have really become vehicles for magic and for witchcraft. And, you know, we've kind of adapted them to use them for all sorts of things. And when we look at the history going back into kind of some of the most ancient mentions of flying ointments, they weren't always used for flight. Some of them were used for shape-shifting or, you know, casting other types of spells, often on other people.
Yeah, that happens. So would it help? You know, because a lot of people talk about astral travel and they want to do it and they can't seem to get there. And, you know, it's something that takes a while and some people get impatient. Would that be helpful for doing some astral travel?
Absolutely. So it's going to lower the inhibitions. A lot of the plants included are going to affect the pineal gland, which is associated with psychic ability and things like that. So not everybody is able to access those states or achieve the same effects using other shamanic techniques like drumming or chanting or visualization or things like that. So we've got these plant allies available that can sort of act as a key or a stepping stone to sort of help people get there. And then once you've gotten there, then it's much easier to return on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, in a lot of things, people don't have the confidence to think that they can do it. So when they try, it's kind of like, doesn't work because you have to believe in what you're doing, right? So that might be, you know, a little help. I don't know. But, you know, there's a ton of information and tips in the book. For example, anointing magical tools with hemlock, which not only consecrates them, but also empowers the tool, or making a tincture from California poppies for anxiety, insomnia, and pain. What's your best advice for someone who wants to begin working with baneful herbs but just doesn't know quite how to get started?
Well, now there's luckily more information available, so just read and research and all of that, but start looking into plants that are maybe not deadly poison, but plants that are invasive or considered invasive. Plants that have thorns or plants that have some other characteristic that makes them a little bit or makes humans a little bit leery of them. You know, there's all different types of baneful herbs and there's all different types of ways that we can utilize those qualities in magic and for spiritual growth and gnosis and things like that. So there's a lot of plants that have kind of that darker or otherworldly or wild connection that aren't as dangerous as hemlock or wolfsbane or hellebore, plants that you really would never want to ingest and really need to be careful of. So kind of getting an idea for that concept of what is baneful and also kind of the idea of poison, that poison is also medicine. You know, it's the same constituents that make a plant poisonous are also what make it medicinal. So it all comes down to the dosage and just kind of rewiring our brains to not automatically shut down when we see that word poison, because poison can mean a lot of different things. It can mean a stomach ache.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So, all right, so if somebody says, okay, I want to start a baneful herb garden, which particular herbs, the baby ones, I guess to call it, would you suggest for them to start off with?
So the nightshades are notoriously tricky to germinate. Some of the easier ones to get started are henbane, datura. A lot of the datura, or you'll find it as angel's trumpet or brugmansia, things like that, you can actually find ornamentally. You would be surprised what traditional witches' herbs can be found in just your neighborhood garden nursery.
Okay, yeah, because, I mean, it's something interesting. I mean, the book has so many rituals and recipes and things that it kind of makes you, just reading the book, want to start your garden even if you don't have one. You know, because there's so many different ways. You talk about how to cultivate the plants, you know, and some people think that if the plant has a reputation as being poisonous, it's not necessarily the whole plant. You know, it might be the berry or the stem or the flower. And so you use the parts, you know, different ways. And some parts you just don't use at all. wash your hands really quick and get rid of it. Another chat room question just came in. They want to know if people ever come to you and ask you to create some poisonous concoctions for them that could harm somebody else.
No one has ever approached me in that regard seriously. I've had a lot of people, and it's generally when I'm doing an in-person event or an expo, and it's not strictly for the magical community. And I'll have, you know, just a regular person that comes along and sees the name Poisoner's Apothecary and they'll say, oh, I need that for my husband, you know, when he's whatever, not being very nice. You know, they'll make little jokes, little comments like that. And, you know, I laugh with them, but, you know, that's like the complete opposite of what I am trying to do and what I'm trying to provide for people. I've had a couple of just silly questions that would lead to somebody doing something dangerous. And I usually shut that down pretty quickly. But most people that are genuinely inquisitive about working with these plants are, you know, they're not morons like these people that are, you know, coming up with these ridiculous questions on, you know, how can I poison my ex-boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah, well, that happened. So, you know, I mean, it's an honest question because I'm sure that at some point somebody will try to get away with it. You know, will he do that for me? And, you know, oh, and then if they get caught, well, he did it. You know, my hands are clean. There was something I'm looking up here really, really quickly. Yeah, this is something I want to talk about for a minute. I want to talk about the book of Saturn, the book of Venus, and the book of Mercury. How do these planets play into this?
So that was sort of a system of categorization that I use to present the plants in the book. It matched a pattern that I started to notice when I was researching about these plants that are associated with magic and witchcraft, that they started to kind of follow kind of a pattern, and it matched up with sort of these archetypal energies that we think of when we think of traditional witchcraft or folkloric witchcraft, you know, out of medieval Europe. So we have this idea of sort of the horned god or the witch father and being sort of this very dark, chthonic, earthly type of a figure being associated with Saturn. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got the Queen of Elfheim, the Witch Queen, Witch Goddess, Hecate, whatever names that you'd like to use for her. And I've associated that with Venus. And that's not to say that it's all love and light on that side either, because Venus is a very duplicitous planetary energy as well. And then we have Mercury, which is kind of the go-between or the androgynous child of those two, the witch queen and the witch father, representing this sort of mercurial trickster type of a spirit. So I use that to kind of categorize this idea of these different currents that we're working in when we're doing these types of practices, and not so much to compartmentalize the planetary correspondence of each herb, because a lot of them fall under more than one category.
You know, I'm looking through things here that I've written so many notes about, and I'm trying to say, can we get this all in? But one of the things is, you know, you have the chapter on walking the crooked path, which is the preparation and formulation. I mean, you get very, very deep into these things. I mean, it's not like an extraction method, for example. I mean, you have several, you know, there's not just one. And you have a thing about weights and measures and apothecary system measurements and, you know, infused oils and tinctures and all that. I mean, this is really, I mean, I think it's like a good recipe book. It's like a good grimoire. I mean, it's got a whole lot in it. And I think that's really neat. It's not just something that you touch on one particular thing for about 2 seconds and then move on to the next. And I think that's really important because it's kind of a learning thing for everybody. You know, you've answered the questions before they were asked. I guess maybe that's a better way of saying it.
Yeah, they're questions that I've had to ask myself too in trying to, you know, figure it out for myself, and something that's largely been missing. You know, this information isn't presented in this way with this amount of practical information from the perspective of magical practice or using them in an esoteric capacity. So unless you're studying to be a clinical herbalist or something like that, you're not really going to find that much usable information about these plants. And I believe that the information should be in everyone's hands, and they can make the determination of how and if and when to use it.
Yeah, and you also kind of get, for crafty people, I mean, like you have how to make a home protection wreath, which is really kind of very simple, actually. Mm-hmm. And so it's there's something for everybody, I think. You know, some of the tinctures and like for belladonna, you talk about dosage and preparation, and I mean, yeah, it's very cool. I mean, I kept looking and looking and looking and finding all these things that just really intrigued me and makes me want to like sit down and read the book cover to cover to cover to cover to get some of it in my head. And I will. All right. So, you know, there's a whole lot of more things in the book that we don't have time to get to, but so before we, in the last, you know, like 10 minutes or whatever we have, I want to talk about, I want to hear about the Poisoner's Apothecary. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so the Poisoner's Apothecary is my online business. It's where I sell all of my formulas and offer all of my recorded classes and things like that. It's kind of the umbrella that I operate under. Product-wise, it is where I create all of my entheogenic ritual formulas, flying ointments, spell oils, and occult artifacts. I also create jewelry inspired by poisonous plants, containing poisonous plants, or just poison jewelry in general.
I saw that, and it reminded me, I think I was like 13, and I had a poison ring. And of course, I had nothing in it, but, you know, it was just, oh, look, I have a poison ring. But, oh, you've got a beautiful one with moonstone, by the way. But you've also got, I mean, so in if people want to, oh, wait a minute. Okay, question. Do you sell seeds?
I do sell seeds as well.
And tinctures and ink and tea blends.
Yes.
And some very beautiful potion bottles. You know, and I mean, I told him earlier that before the show that I went to his store and I was just drooling. I was going, oh my God, yeah. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff there. So, you know, it's really kind of a nice place to get lost for a while. You know, and if you want to do some magic that you know that you need specific things, he doesn't have just like one or two things. I mean, you know, if you don't have time to concoct your own tincture or you need a certain salve, probably find it there, wouldn't they?
Definitely. There's, I think, around 175 items on the website currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about a good starter kit for somebody if they actually need it. So let me just ask you, I mean, what did you think it, or why would you think it was necessary to write this book? I mean, you know, we usually when we write a book, it's because there's a specific need that we think. Are there very many books like this out in the market? And maybe, you know, maybe you wrote this because, again, people were asking questions and things like that. How did that genesis start?
I would say it just came from a need and a desire, both in myself and in the community, just a desire for this information, you know, the historical information, the magical lore, most importantly, the practical information, and just kind of the how-to for this path, because there is so much there, and there is so little that has been written about it, and what has been written about it is all scattered across, you know, time and whatever, and there's really not another book that is exactly like this. Not to toot my own horn, but just, you know, having studied and researched this and, you know, kind of aware of everything that is written on the topic that's been published in the past couple of hundred years, it's really one of a kind, and it's really been, you know, part of my own personal journey in kind of providing this information, and that's always kind of been the main purpose and goal and motivation is education and research and writing and sharing this information.
You have a ton of works cited, you know, different things. Did you go digging around like way back when? I mean, is there a lot written from hundreds or maybe even thousands of years ago? Because this kind of magic and these kinds of potions and everything have been here for probably since man began, right?
Yeah. Very, very, very long time. You know, some of them even, you know, ancient Egypt, Sumeria, the Stone Age, you know, it goes way, way back that we have people using these plants. And there is a gap in the information and the lore, you know, a lot of it being orally passed down for such a long time. And, you know, we've got, thanks to the Catholic Church and the Inquisition and stamping out all of our traditional herbal knowledge, you know, a lot of it has been lost. So,
yeah. So somebody started thinking about, well, we better bring that back, you know, because, yeah, I think there's probably a lot written about it now, but of course nobody's got the papyrus from Egypt or, you know, all the things that had to be burned or hidden because people wanted to live during the burning times. So, yeah, I mean, this kind of incorporates way back and modern times as well.
Yeah, with what we know today, you know, with things like microdosing and different things like that, you know, there's a lot of new application that hasn't even been explored with a lot of these ancient plants.
Yeah, I mean, the old saying, everything old is new again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in my practice, I mean, I revere the ancient ones. I love the old ways. The new ways are fine too, but you know, there's something special about going back and picking up things that have been lost and things that work just as well now as they did then, but a lot of people didn't hear about it or know about it. And so, yeah, this is kind of a very important book in that respect. You know, you've got the history and you're bringing stuff back. I noticed that you have an event coming up in March, Botanica Obscure. Where can people find out more about that?
Yeah, the Botanica Obscura Conference, that is at botanicaobscuraconference.com. You can also find a landing page for that on my website, The Poisoner's Apothecary. That's going to be March 19th and 20th. It is a two-day educational event where I've brought together a number of different poison path practitioners, psychedelic historians, herbalists, and other people of interest. And we're all doing some really unique presentations. And we're going to be having a really cool group discussion panel where we'll kind of be doing like what we're doing right now with questions and different talking points and things that we'll go through. To get everyone's perspective together.
And where is this going to be?
That's going to be held live on Zoom meetings. The tickets are available on Eventbrite. And again, all that information you can find if you go to the BotanicaObscuraConference.com website.
That sounds really interesting. How many people do you have in more or less?
I counted, and actually, I have 13 presenters, I believe. So I have a whole coven, and I didn't even do it on purpose.
I was going to just say that's an appropriate number.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. And after the live, are you going to put it like podcast it, or you know, some people that couldn't make it then might be able to see it?
Yes, I will be recording the presentations. Recordings will probably not go out for about a week or so after the live airs, but I would like to make those available for people who aren't able to make the event.
Okay, good. And there's one more place that people can go looking for you, and that's the houseoftwigs.com. Now, what will they find there?
So there you will find a collection of my articles. There's Tom Hatzis writes for the House of Twigs, Laura Tempest Zakroff. So some really good articles there. You can also go to their School of Ritual at learn.thehouseoftwigs.com. And there you'll find my most extensive Poison Path course. It is a work at your own pace written course that will tell you everything you need to know. It's got a lot of different information than what's actually in the book. Things more along the lines of shadow work and plant spirit familiars and plant gnosis and things like that, and incorporating into meditation and yogic practice and what have you. So that's at learn.thehouseoftwigs.com.
Wow. So you're all over the place, and this is good.
I am.
Well, we need you. So we're going to have to get going in about a minute. So I want to thank you for being with us tonight. And I also want to thank everybody who's listening in. And we've got some good shows coming up in the new year. And so I hope everybody does have a happy new year. And Kobe, come back at some point. Let's do some more talking.
Yeah, I'd love to. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks. All right, everybody. Until next time, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.